I have a specific one, which is going to Jones Beach in New York and hearing this song called, and I don't know what it's called actually, but it had the line "My love has no bottom," which I thought was hilarious as a however the hell old I was at that age.
Yeah, I was kind of fascinated by the car radio, and I guess I was about 4 years old when the Beatles arrived, and basically when every new song came on the radio, I would ask my mother if it was the Beatles.
I like how everything might have been the Beatles at that age.
Yeah, I mean,
No, that's Rachmaninoff. Is that the Beatles?
Yeah. But
No.
I was sort of singularly fascinated with the Beatles. I think just because they were kind of like a gang of boys.
You guys first met as teenagers growing up in Lincoln, Massachusetts. What
That's right.
effect did growing up there have on the way you sound today?
I think we are in many ways, suburban guys, who grew up in the turbulent 60s and 70s, and all that kind of stuff plays into our sort of cultural identity a lot. I think there's this thing about, music in general, rock music in general, which is there's this sort of both this fascination with authenticity and this very cavalier rejection of authenticity. And I think, when you grow up in the suburbs, you are an expert in rejecting authenticity in a very authentic way. It's a paradoxical thing. It's like you're placing, we grew up with television and pop music and, all this disposable stuff. And that's really a lot of the topic of what we're doing. So it's not like we're not thinking about it, but we can't pretend that we're like living on an island or something. It's like we're definitely in the electronic modern world.
Well, I was intrigued to read that John Flansburgh, one of your first jobs in New York was counting commuters at Grand Central
Yeah, I
Station.
did that for a number of years. I worked for Metro North. It was a strange job. I actually worked in management, although I don't think anybody would think we
That's in
were.
quotation marks.
Yeah, but there was a lot of strikes from the engineers and conductors on the trains, and all, and they couldn't get reliable counts of how many people are actually riding the trains for years and years from the 70s on, basically. And so these like teams of weirdos would basically flood onto the floor of Grand Central Station with little clickers, and we would count all the people coming off the trains, and then we'd actually go out on the lines and be standing in some far-flung train station at 4:30 in the morning counting the first commuters coming on. It was a really weird job, but it was actually a very good place to kind of get your head together. And I actually, I wrote a bunch of songs at that job. It was peaceful.
What's the songwriting process like for you guys?
We each write songs generally separately, and we have a million different ways of getting started. I'd say, we both play instruments and sing, but we also occasionally we'll write lyrics down and then try and construct the song around the lyrics. I'd say that probably the most common thing for me, and maybe for John, is to come up with sort of a capsule idea for the song, like a something that might become the chorus or the song title, and then work from there. But then, very often it's something way more tangential that inspires the rest of the song, like a little melodic idea or a whole. This sounds wrong and crazy, but you can actually write a whole song based on some cool new reverb sound that you just heard.
Or, I think you can kind of set a goal to try to write something within a parameter. If you're actively songwriting, you're often not even just working on one song at one time. You're really in this world of writing. So you do a lot of, you kind of do a lot of experimental days, a lot of like sort of research days where you'll be thinking, I'm gonna try to write a song that only uses two chords, or I'm going to try to write a song where the melody stays the same, but the chord, there's this whole chord progression that work, almost, that changes key against it. And, it's just kind of this, we just kind of live in these little music labs and just try to, cook up as much stuff as we can.
We've been driving around from one end of this town to the other and back, but no one's ever seen us.
you've said recently you really care about the entertainment value of the show. I'm wondering, how much responsibility do you feel to your audience versus to your own creative impulse?
Well, they're very similar thing. They're really related ideas, you know, and I think we use one to gauge the other. We don't actually know personally the people in the audience, so we you know, there just isn't enough time in the day to ask everybody, you know, what
right.
What
turn on the lights. We got to talk to these people.
So we have always written for ourselves in that sense. You know, in other words, we know exactly what we like. But we know, for example, if we were going out to see a show and we'd spend a bunch of money, and it's a, you know, I mean, for me now, it's like, you know, parking, babysitter, blah, blah. It's a big deal to go out. So it's not something that we treat lightly. It's like, oh, we'll just, you know, stand up there and jam for 2 hours. I think it is a serious thing to ask people to come and see your band. And
putting together a show that actually has depth to it is a very big artistic challenge, you know. And there's some things you can't change about the presentation of a rock show, but it isn't just necessarily about like delivering the hits, you know. I mean, I think when you think about like, you know, the responsibility of a performer,
right,
it usually ends up meaning like play your hit. But I think there's actually like a larger responsibility than that, and that is don't be mediocre.
Right. That's right.
Is it true that you guys don't really like it when your music is referred to as quirky?
You know, for us, you know, we feel like we're ambassadors to a world of possibilities in popular music that we want people to open their minds to. You know, we feel like rock music is this great thing that can be diverse and incorporate a whole bunch of ideas beyond just being like the bad kid in high school, or like, you know, giving it to the man, or flipping the bird to your boss. You know, like there's this whole mediocre thing about rock music that is just so over and boring and horrible and should be destroyed. And that's our message, is destroy the stuff and get past it. But what happens is people just pick up on all these sort of simple, obvious cues, like, one of the guys in the band wears glasses. You must have gone to school too long. And, you know, that's a very superficial way of looking at things. And, you know, if that's all it takes for you to think like, oh, you know, you're that kind of rock and roll, well, you know, you're just not paying that much attention.
Why do you guys do this?
You know, we have a lot of ways of talking about what the point of what we're doing is, but we would have been doing this, I'm pretty sure, even if there were never a job for us, because we started out that way. We even in high school we were putting together, you know, musical things but also other kinds of creative projects, and it was obviously some kind of a compulsion on both of our part. And, you know, we know other people who engage in this kind of thing as well, but we were lucky in that we got a job, you know, at a certain point doing exactly the thing that we'd been doing. We didn't have to sort of fit slot it into some other official kind of job. You know, we just continued doing the thing that we were compulsive about doing, and it became validated, you know, in the eyes of a lot of people because we're making money at it. You know, that we'd be crazy people if we were doing exactly what we're doing, but we were still doing some other job to support it. You know,
so you're saying we're crazy?
No, I'm saying you can't tell that we're crazy.